It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to this week's Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. Bill, we have so much to catch up on. We had a week off because it was the All-Star break and summer vacation, and you were away and I was off, and lots of stuff happened in the last couple of weeks, so I don't know if we can cram everything into a single Twin Bills, but we're going to do our best here. This is Bill Corey, the sports editor of the Journal. With me is Bill Koch, our Red Sox writer. Happy to be inside an air-conditioned office on this sweltering Saturday afternoon, where I swear, Bill, it feels 10 degrees hotter here than at home.
Yeah, it's nothing personal to the folks who work here, but generally, you know, as a baseball writer, you're not in the office very much. Today is one of those days where I'm actually glad that I am here, though, having functioning air conditioning. Right. It's a beautiful thing. It's a horrendous day outside. The heat index is well over 100. It's going to be the same on Sunday. But it's very much worthwhile to come in here for the AC and to get back to the Twin Bills. For folks who aren't in the room, and that's all of you, but Bill and I. Bill Corey's looking tanned and rested off his own personal All-Star break.
Tan, anyway.
Well, off his own personal All-Star break last week. And as he said, with the Red Sox, there's never a dull moment. But in the period from the last podcast to this one, it seems like there's been even more volume on the news side, even more things happening.
Lots of stuff,
Boston.
Absolutely. So we're going to jump right in here with the, I think the first thing we'll hit on this week, Bill, is the David Price, Dennis Eckersley ongoing feud, which kind of reared its ugly head out of nowhere a couple of weeks back when there was a Chad Finn story in the Globe and then a WEEI story. And, you know, to me, this all goes back to a single word that Dennis Eckersley uttered about a bad outing that Eduardo Rodriguez had, and that word was yuck.
Correct.
And boy, a lot has come of that. What do you make of this whole thing?
It's a mess, obviously. It's a bad look for the team. It's a bad look for everyone involved. I will say that, you know, as someone who had to cover this story this week, I wish it would go away. I know that there's a prevailing opinion out there.
It's a talker, though, Bill.
Well, I understand that, and I understand that there's a prevailing opinion out there from some people on social media that the folks who cover the team are loving this because it's getting exposure to what we write, and it's getting people to buy the newspaper or read us online or whatever else. Nothing could be further from the truth. I don't enjoy any of this. I think it's a soap opera. I would rather focus on what's going on in the field. But considering that you have a pitcher who is of great importance and great prominence with the current Red Sox, and someone who, you know, is a legend with the club and a very successful analyst on NESN currently, you're going to have something that is going to be in the sports pages, going to be written about, going to be talked about, and that's how we find ourselves here.
You know, I'm old enough to remember watching Dennis Eckersley pitch with the Red Sox. Mm. And he was a very good starting pitcher. Obviously, he had some struggles, left Boston, and really became the Hall of Fame pitcher when he was with the Oakland A's as the
that came into my era a little bit in the late 80s.
As the closer.
Yes.
Just really automatic. I mean, he was lights-out closer for several years, playing for Tony La Russa, followed La Russa to St. Louis, eventually came back to the Red Sox for a single season at the end of his career. And, you know, I love Dennis Eckersley on the broadcast. He tells it like it is. I like the Eckisms. I like the pair of shoes. I like the cheese. I like the hair, the moss, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for Eckersley, first of all, I will say this. I think David Price really kind of overreacted to a very simple criticism of a very bad pitching outing. That wasn't even about him. It was about Erod.
This all the way back in July 2017.
We're going back 2 years
yes.
now, right? Where Eck basically said yuck.
Correct.
And to kind of refresh people's memories, there was a incident on a team plane. Eckersley came in. Price said something to him along the lines of, oh, this guy thinks it's easy or something like that.
Right.
And that's really never been kind of resolved.
Correct.
Which, you know, makes me wonder, why haven't the Red Sox, or why hasn't Nesson, why hasn't somebody pulled these guys into a room and say, guys, just can you hash this out? It seems like a pretty simple thing.
Yeah, for me, this type of thing, and you know, I would actually defer to your experience on this because, you know, for the folks who listen to the podcast, they might know that Bill Corey has two daughters. And I've met one of them. She's lovely. I'm sure your other young lady is equally lovely. But yes, I'm also certain that at times, as their father, there are times where they are squabbling. And, sure. You know, as a parent, you don't want that sort of thing to fester and to linger. And so you sit them down in a room and you say, all right, ladies.
Especially if it's a silly thing.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's one thing if they genuinely disagree on something that's meaty and you know, significant.
Right.
But, you know, this is kind of a silly thing. I mean, you know, he said yuck about a bad outing. You know, I don't think it would have taken that much to kind of hash it out. But anyway, that didn't happen.
This would be along the lines later. Of she used my hairbrush or my shampoo.
Right.
It's like, all right, stop it.
Yeah, right.
Both of you.
Right.
Cut it out.
Right. I'll go buy you a new $3 hairbrush or something.
Right? Sit in the room, talk to each other, hug it out, and that's it. It's over.
I don't see Dave Price as a hugger. But
no, and that goes back to your initial point. Someone from the Red Sox and someone from Nesson should have stepped in.
Yeah.
There should have been mediation on both sides. There should have been a meeting that was not optional attendance. Price and Eckersley should have been forced to go to the meeting.
Probably, yeah.
And this would be over.
Yeah.
It would be over.
I sort of thought it was over, you know, and then it just came up out of the blue.
Well, and that's where we run into some difficulty here. You know, apparently at the time. Now, I want to say this very clearly before we get started. David Price was wrong. What he did to Eckersley was wrong on that flight. You know, Eck was commenting on a rehab start by Eduardo Rodriguez where he had a very difficult time. They showed his final line on the broadcast, and Eck's reaction to it was yuck. That got passed along to David Price somehow, and he sort of expressed himself to Eckersley in this sort of misguided, insecure way of flexing his muscles, of sort of demonstrating leadership. I think he has the wrong perception of that. I think he has it wrong. He sees it as, I'm going to stick up for Rodriguez in this way. I feel it's my duty as someone older, as his teammate, to defend him against Eckersley for being so flippant and so critical of him. I think he overplays that a little bit.
Right.
I also think that he misunderstands Eckersley's role on the broadcast. Eck is good TV.
Oh, he's great.
He is.
Yeah, he's great.
He's good TV. That doesn't mean, being good TV does not mean that you're going to like everything he has to say. I mean, you grew up in the era of Howard Cosell. You understand what it's like.
Sure.
You're trying to be thought-provoking. You're trying to be a little bit incendiary. It's not always going to be, you know, vanilla ice cream and we're going to go to bed after that. That's not what Eckersley does. He is excellent on Nesson in that regard, but every once in a while, that's going to grate on some feelings because he is going to tell it like it is and be a little critical.
And that's what we love about Eckersley.
Correct.
Because he's not somebody that we identify as 100% company man, so to speak.
Correct.
If he sees something on the field that doesn't make sense or he doesn't agree with, he lets you know about it. And that's what you want in a color commentator, you know?
Correct.
And
so those two fundamentally misunderstand each other.
Apparently, yeah.
They do.
Right. I think Price thinks that Eckersley's supposed to be a cheerleader or something.
Correct.
And, you know, I think that Eckersley looks at Price and saying, you know, why does this bother you so much over one?
Right, I'm on TV. This is what I'm supposed to do. You're not supposed to care about what I say.
This is my shtick, you know?
So we go back to 2017 and we have that initial incident. And Price was wrong. Period. Keep that in mind because I'm about to say some things that you won't like. Price realizes he's wrong. He asks for a meeting with Eckersley about a month later. That meeting is set up. He gets to Fenway Park early, and Eck doesn't show. If Dennis Eckersley shows up to that meeting, it's over. Now, he's not obligated to do so. He was the one who was wrong. But this would have been finished. It would have been.
Yeah.
They would have heard each other out. Guaranteed they would have come to some sort of understanding and not talked about it again. You flash forward to February 2018, spring training. Price is asked about it again. And he says, I apologize to Eck. I handled it wrong. I wish I had done it differently. I'm content to not talk about it again.
I mean, he basically said the right thing at that point.
And he didn't for another 16 months.
Right.
He didn't speak about that incident again until this week. Eckersley's comments in the Chad Finn piece, the way that they were repackaged by WEI and put out onto social media, that's what Price saw. That clickbait headline repackaging, one line in a 2,000-word profile
right.
that was put up there to make Price look bad. He reacted to that.
Mm.
And I think that's where you have this latest flashpoint from. Now, I would look back and I would say, Chad Finn was absolutely right to ask Eckersley about the incident. That's his job as a reporter. It was a big story. Eck responded pretty benignly.
Hmm.
You know, he sort of said, I don't know what I'm, you know, I don't know how he expects me to handle it. I'm ready to move on, whatever. Very simply, Eck could have said no comment. I'm not going there, Chad. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Once he does that, it doesn't even get included in Finn's piece. He doesn't even bring it up. It's 2,000 words without that. He just cuts that part out. It's gone.
Right.
But that's not Eck. That's not who he is. He doesn't do no comment. It was asked and answered, and it blows up into this.
Right. And the answer was, you know, I have no plans on meeting with him, never, essentially.
Right.
Something like that.
So in that respect, you know, Eck isn't entirely clean in all this.
Right.
Not entirely. You know, mostly he's still the aggrieved party on the balance, but he's not entirely clean.
Right. He had the opportunity to go and sit down with.
Say, no, I'm not talking about that.
Right. Or to meet with Price, you know,
skip
a little
the meeting,
while. Right.
And he also could have said, I'm not talking about
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not doing that. And now we have more today from Cooperstown, where Eck was talking to Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe. And he said that David Price is essentially my new Kirk Gibson. He's my new, you know, great adversary here. What's that going to do to kill this?
Yeah. No, that's going to make it worse.
That's going to make it even worse.
Yeah.
So this is the bottom line is this is just bad on both sides. It's a bad look for the team. It's a bad look for Nesson. It's a bad look for Price. It's a bad look for Eckersley.
Yeah.
It's something that should have been squashed a long time ago. And I could see a room with four people in it. Price, Eck, Kevin Gregg, who's Red Sox Vice President of Public Relations.
Yeah.
And pick someone else. Dale Arnold. Dave yeah. O'Brien. He can be
right.
ex-corner person.
Right.
The four of them get in a room. They hash it out. You've got the neutral parties there to calm everything yeah. down if they start screaming at one another.
Yeah.
And it's over. But that should have been done a long time ago. And the fact that it hasn't leads us to where we are now.
Yeah. You know, and I agree that Eck is not exactly squeaky clean on this. You know, he had some comments that were critical of Marcus Stroman not too long ago, the Blue Jays pitcher, being a little too demonstrative on the mound.
Who was teammates with Price in Toronto in 2015.
Right, right. And, you know, as you and I were talking earlier, of all people, Eckersley, and I remember Eckersley as a closer, and so do you.
Sure.
I mean, he was pretty demonstrative, wasn't he, when he punched somebody out?
No question.
So, I mean, for him to...
He was hypocritical there.
Right. For him to come out and say a little too demonstrative, I mean, you know... That definitely was hypocritical, but anyway, we'll see. We'll see what the next shoe to drop in this thing is. I'm amazed it's lasted this long. It clearly got some new fuel to the fire, but you know, like you said, it could have been handled and ended a long time ago.
Should have.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's turn our attention to what's actually happening on the field,
please.
So some recent changes here with the Red Sox rotation, and that is recently they've added Andrew Cashner from the Baltimore Orioles. Did not have a sterling outing for the Red Sox a few days back.
No.
This is basically an innings eater, you know, somebody who's probably the four or five guy in the rotation. What do you think of that trade, Bill?
I think it was something the Red Sox had to do. If you look at what's happened in that fifth spot in the rotation, going back to April when Nathan Eovaldi went on the injured list, that five spot, you'd rotated through Brian Johnson, Hector Velasquez, Josh Smith, Ryan Weber, Darwinson Hernandez. That five spot had over a 6 ERA, over a 150 whip, and they were short outings. They were leaving your bullpen exposed. They're having to cover 15 outs, 18 outs every fifth day. It's just too much.
Right.
So I think Cashner is someone who can give them a little bit of length. They gave up very little price for him. Two 17-year-old prospects, Nolberth Romero and Elio Prado, who were in the Dominican Summer League. Baltimore is paying all of Cashner's salary, which is important if the Red Sox want to make another move.
Doesn't hurt their caps, their salary cap space.
Correct. They still have about $6 million to play with under the competitive balance tax. So I think generally it's a very low-risk move for Boston to make to address an area of need.
And in doing so, a couple of other things happened on the roster, namely Eduardo Nunez was designated for assignment. So what becomes of Eduardo Nunez now?
He was officially given his release earlier today, which means he's free to sign with any club for the veterans minimum. Mm-hmm. His contract was going to run out at the end of this season. I think it's important to note that Nunez exercised a player option for himself. That was not a team option. Mm. It was a one-year, $6 million deal for 2018 with a player option built in for 2019. So it was his choice to be here this year. It wasn't necessarily Boston's. And he just didn't perform. They had him in a role where they sort of wanted him to play against left-handed pitching, and he wasn't necessarily hitting them. Brock Holt is back and healthy and looking good. Mm-hmm. Marco Hernandez has more long-term value to them in terms of someone who is under team control for a while and who can play multiple positions. And then Michael Chavis, obviously, has emerged and taken a lot of the other at-bats that Nunez might have gotten.
Sure.
So I think it's sad to see him go. He was a really nice guy, really well liked in the clubhouse, particularly by Bogarts, by Rafael Devers, by Eduardo Rodriguez. Those guys were very close. But it's a move that they definitely need to make, and I think it was something that had been coming for a little bit.
And there have been other changes on the roster too. Brazier has been sent down to Pawtucket. And as of today, on Saturday, they have activated Nathan Eovaldi, who, as we know now, will be in the mix for the bullpen. So as the Red Sox really are approaching sort of the do-or-die part of the schedule, which we'll get to in a second, the roster is getting a little refresher. And, I'm excited to see what happens with Nathan Eovaldi in the bullpen. I mean, I think he can do it. I'm not convinced that he wants to do it. But I think, as you and I have said many times on the podcast, they need another arm in that bullpen. And he's got a great arm.
Yeah, I think you're making the best of an imperfect situation here. If you were going to bring him back as a starter, he probably wouldn't be ready to be activated until mid-August. Let's say.
Because you have to stretch them out.
Right. Yeah. So 20, 25 games from now, and they're coming up on a really critical stretch in the schedule, playing the Rays and playing the Yankees. Any sort of postseason chase that they were going to be on could be lost already by then. So you definitely, you want to sort of try to maximize him down the stretch, and that means bringing him out of the bullpen. And I think what you're going to see is, him, Matt Barnes, and Brandon Workman on the back end, sort of two really power arms there, Barnes and Eovaldi, and, someone in Workman who opposing hitters have really struggled against, in terms of batting average and slugging percentage, it's negligible what they've done against him.
Do you think that there will be a designated closer, or do you think it'll be basically Barnes and Eovaldi, depending on the matchup, depending on the day kind of thing?
I think they've sort of settled on Workman for that role. What I really think this is designed to do, and I think we even saw this last year, is Alex Cora sort of had like two different platoons in his bullpen. He had the winning bullpen and he had the losing bullpen. And it was, the guys, when they were winning games, they were going to get used. Mm-hmm. And certain other guys, when they were losing games, those guys were going to get used.
Right, right.
I think what this is designed to do is to give him a couple more quality arms so that when they're down 4-2, he doesn't put one of the B-side in. I think this acknowledges the fact that they need to win games.
Yeah, yeah.
They're on the outside.
You can't just automatically give up at that point, right?
That's right. And so if it's a 4-2 game in the sixth inning, he's not going to go to Josh Smith if he's up there. He's not going to go to Hector Velasquez if he was up here. Like last year, he would have gone to Joe Kelly losing 4-2 or Heath Hembree.
Right.
He wasn't going to go to Barnes, Kimbrell, Brazier. Those three guys were sort of the back end, preferred back end guys by the end of the season.
Right. That was the winning bullpen.
Correct. They were not going to pitch in a 5-3 game in the eighth inning. It wasn't going to happen.
Right.
But now I think you're seeing a little bit of a shift and a little bit of acknowledgement, really, by the Red Sox that they're on the outside looking in for a playoff berth right now. And, making these moves, whether it's changes in the lineup or changes in the pitching staff, sort of acknowledges the fact that they do need to win games here.
Absolutely. And as another piece of the roster change here is Mitch Moreland, who you saw last night in Pawtucket, is going to get another game, at least one more game down there. What's the status of Moreland? How long do you think before he will be back with the big club?
Played five innings on Friday night. He went 0-for-2 with a walk. That was a seven-pitch at-bat in the first inning. He looked good in that one. Only had a couple chances in the field, but looked to be moving pretty well. He's back in the Paw Sox lineup on Saturday. The goal is for him to play seven innings. Ideally, he gets four at-bats. And then I think they'll have a discussion in Boston about whether or not to activate him. I think he's someone who they've missed in the lineup. Chavis has done well as a rookie at first base. But you look at Moreland, and through his 47 games this year, he had 22 extra base hits, which is pretty good clip that he was going at in terms of doubles and home runs. And I just think that they miss that bat in the lineup, particularly against right-handed pitching. They miss his professionalism, his leadership. Not that there isn't some there already in the clubhouse. There is. It's not like they're rudderless or anything like that. But he's a key piece there. He's a guy who gets along with everybody and sort of comforting to have there. He's had some big moments in the middle of that lineup.
Sure.
So someone who they would welcome back with open arms if he's healthy and ready to go.
Today is July 20th, and as I look at the standings, the division leaders in the American League are the Yankees, the Twins, and the Houston Astros.
Yep.
The two wild card holders at this point, anyway, are the Cleveland Indians and the Oakland A's.
Correct.
So Tampa Bay is a half game out of that, and the Red Sox are 2.5 games out of that.
Yep.
And they have a game tonight in Baltimore, although, last night that didn't go so well in Baltimore.
Did not.
David Price got hit around pretty good as they dropped that game. So they get tonight and tomorrow in Baltimore. And then they've got, as you alluded to earlier, the Yankees and the Rays basically for 2 weeks, right, Bill?
Right.
So this is essentially do or die here. I mean, you can come out of these 2 weeks and your season could essentially be over. Or you could really fight and make a go of it and get yourself right back in the thick of the wild card race. I don't think you're going to catch up to the Yankees in terms of the division. But, I remember 1978, and it can happen, but it probably is not going to happen. So what are we thinking here heading into these 2 weeks?
Well, first things first, let's take on the challenges that are in front of you. The Rays are directly in front of you. Cleveland and Oakland directly in front of you. Those are the teams that you need to overtake first,
right,
before you worry about the Yankees. Of course you want to win the division.
Right.
And of course you want to get into the ALDS.
Yeah, you just need W's at this point. It doesn't matter who.
Correct. You need to get to a point where you are in playoff position and you've jumped those three teams. And then you can worry about trying to chase the Yankees, as unlikely as that would be that you're going to catch them with 60 games left. You need to worry about taking care of the Rays, taking care of Cleveland when you go there in August. You're all done with Oakland, but you hope that maybe Houston can do a number on them somehow, they might have an injury or something along those lines. But it's one of those things where I think Boston just needs to really handle their own business. You're playing Tampa, who's sort of sliding a little bit now. They're struggling a little bit.
Yep.
The Yankees are still going along pretty good and will be a tough opponent. You actually get them to come to Fenway Park for the first time this year, so maybe you have a chance to do a little something against them.
Well, you did have two home games with them.
Home games
quote in London.
Fingers. My quote fingers are in the air.
Neither of which worked out very well.
Oh, my God, and both of which took about 5 hours. It was a total joke. But that's one of those things that, yes, you're playing the next 2 weeks against the two best teams in your division right now, the two teams who are in front of you. You've struggled against teams with 500 records or better. So this is your real test. You come out of this and you're 8-6, 9-5, something like that. That's a pretty good go. What you really need to avoid, though, is something like a 4-10, a 5-9, because you'll really be losing ground head-to-head with the teams that you need to take care of.
It would really be surprising and supremely disappointing if the Red Sox did not make at least the playoffs a year after winning 108 games, winning the World Series,
Agreed.
And essentially returning the same team.
Agreed.
You know, I think that, you know, thinking that they could repeat is maybe a little too lofty at the beginning of the season. Certainly not, they weren't going to win another 108 games, but to not even make the playoffs would be really disappointing for a team that truly has, you look at their on paper and you say, well, they've got the talent to do it. And I'm sure the front office has been saying the same thing. Like, where are these guys? What's happening?
Right.
And, you know, the trade deadline is now fast approaching,
mm-hmm.
a couple of weeks away. And I don't know, is Andrew Cashner it, or do you think there's more on the way?
Well, the fact that they didn't take on salary for Cashner, I think, is important. I think that they maintain some flexibility by doing that. You know, you still have about $6 million left, which, you know, over the course of a season prorated, you've played, you know, what, about three-fifths of the year at this point?
Mm-hmm.
So you're only taking on 40% of someone's salary. That means you can take on a $14, $15 million player.
Because you're only paying probably...
The last 40%.
Yeah, right.
Whatever that is.
$5 or $6 million.
$6 million. Yeah. So, realistically, you could get a good bullpen arm for that. You know, you could get into a discussion with someone like Jose Abreu from the White Sox, whose contract expires at the end of this year.
Right.
Who the Red Sox have been linked to a little bit in the last week. If the Giants decide that they're going to sell off their bullpen, you could get in on someone like Will Smith. I know Boston was scouting Toronto and Detroit, I believe it was last night. So you could get in on Shane Green, who's Detroit's closer. Mm. Now, everyone in the league is going to be in on Shane Green,
sure.
and Detroit is probably, you know, going to deal off anything that's not nailed down. But, you know, that's the type of guy who you might be able to add. You know, if the Rangers decide to trade Mike Minor, that means they might try to trade Sean Kelly, too, who's their closer.
Right.
Maybe you could get involved with him. You know, so by trading for Cashner and executing the deal the way that they did and forcing Baltimore to pay all of his salary, you've left the door open to potentially making another move. You don't have to declare yourself done here.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to take note of the fact that by staying under the tax, it's not that the Red Sox don't want to pay the money.
Well, they have all the money in the world.
They have it's all not, the money
yeah,
in the world.
Right.
I understand that. And they went over the tax last year. It's not that they don't want to spend. They don't want to give up the draft capital.
Right.
That's what it is. Their first pick this year was 43rd overall. They don't want to be down there anymore. If they miss the playoffs and they end up picking 22nd, they don't want that to turn into 32nd because they went through the tax
right.
again.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the finances. It has everything to do with rebuilding the system. And one of the biggest criticisms of the Red Sox, and Dave Dombrowski specifically, the last two or three years, is he's strip mining the farm system. He's trading all these guys out and bringing in veterans. You know, what do we have for the future? Well, maybe just once, he's deciding not to do that. You know, and now he's being criticized, and John Henry's being criticized because it looks like they don't want to spend.
Right, you're not going out and getting somebody.
There really is no win for them at this point. You're at a spot where if you're going to trade for someone like Shane Green, Sean Kelly, you know, Marcus Stroman even, you know, somebody like that.
That'd be interesting. Get Stroman over here and have Eck call the game.
You want to get in on Matthew Boyd, let's say, the lefty for the Tigers.
Right.
It's going to cost you two or three significant prospects to do that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, your system goes back from, you know, sort of creeping out of that bottom 10 maybe next year.
Right back
to all the way back into the bottom five again. So I think, you know, in that respect, the Cashner deal was very well done. You gave up two guys who weren't in your organizational top 60.
Yep.
You didn't take on any money. Thought that was really intelligent by them. If they're able to make a similar deal for a reliever, you know, for a lesser prospect, good. They've left the door open to do it. I think they should.
Well, they're going to have to, I think, if they want to keep pace here and at least climb back into the race. You know, if, as you said, if they go 5-9 over the next 2 weeks, then what's the point? But if they are able to find some bullpen help, come out of that stretch 9-5 or 10-4 even, or something, you know, that's probably a little too ambitious, but something like that, then you're in business. And then you're right in the thick of things, maybe, you know, with the return of Valdi and Moreland and and the addition of Cashner, maybe you finish down the stretch on a high note and get yourself into the playoffs. But, you know, it's been such a frustrating team to watch, Bill, because there have been, as we've said many times, these glimmers of hope, so to speak, where it looked like maybe they've turned things around a little bit and they've got things on the right track. And then David Price goes down to Baltimore and gets bombed.
Right. The interesting thing about this is, you know, if they win the last two games in Baltimore, they'll be 10 games over 500, which will be the first time in double digits this year.
Right.
And yet it still feels like they're running uphill. They're not really firing on all cylinders.
Right. Well, it's because they've got two teams still ahead of them that are playing even better, and they've got all these teams they have to climb over to get back into the wild card. So.
Right.
So, Bill, before we wrap up this edition of the Twin Bills, we would be remiss if we don't touch upon the passing of Pumpsy Green.
Yes.
Who died this past week. I believe he was 85 years old.
Correct.
And the significance, of course, of Pumpsy Green is that he is the first black player for the Boston Red Sox who joined the team, I want to say, 1959.
July 1959.
It wasn't a great player, but was a pretty good player. And, he was the first African-American on the last team to integrate.
Yes.
And so, therefore, holds a pretty significant spot in Red Sox history.
Yeah. Pumpsy Green, described by Red Sox owner John Henry in a statement this week, as the reluctant pioneer. Mm. Somebody who didn't want, the accolades or the acknowledgement that he was the first African-American player for the Red Sox. He just wanted to play baseball.
Yeah.
But in debuting for the Red Sox on July 21st, 1959, he finally, his playing in that game, finally it forced the team to address what's the most shameful chapter in their history.
Mm.
12 years after Jackie Robinson debuted with the Brooklyn Dodgers, 3 years after Robinson retired from the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Who you could have had as a Red Sox fan.
Who you could have had, who was offered to you in a tryout in 1945.
And Willie Mays as well.
Willie Mays as well. But your owner, Tom Yawkey, was a racist, had racist leanings, didn't want to sign black players, certainly didn't want to put them on the field.
Right.
Boston being the city that it was, with the history that it had, all the way into forced busing in the 70s, has a very bad record on race relations. And that's something that still lingers to this day, nowhere near the severity of it in the 60s and in the 70s. But if you look at NBA free agency, it's something that comes up all the time. Mm. In a league predominantly populated by African-American players, there is still the perception out there that Boston is a racist city in some way. So into all that parachutes Pumpsy Green in 1959, an infielder who played four seasons with the Sox, a final season with the Mets, returned to California, served as a truant officer and a baseball coach at Berkeley High School until his retirement, was married to his wife for 62 years, built the house, actually, that they still lived in to this day.
Wow.
Used his money that he made with the Red Sox to invest in a property that now would probably be worth millions.
Sure.
If his wife decided to sell it, in suburban San Francisco in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
But really, such an important player in the team's history, and it has nothing to do with what happened on the field. It has to do with the fact that now, the most recent Red Sox championship team, you had an African-American as the American League MVP, Mookie Betts. You had an African-American Gold Glove winner right next to him in Jackie Bradley Jr. And you had probably what should have been the World Series MVP, an African-American in David Price.
At least the co-MVP, right?
At least the co-MVP with Steve Pierce.
Yeah.
So 60 years on from this shameful legacy created by Tom Yawkey and sort of the original sin of the Red Sox, you have these great black stars on the team. And I think that, if that is the legacy of Pumpsy Green, the reluctant pioneer aside, if that is his legacy, the fact that this team now has turned into a franchise that welcomes players of all races, all creeds, all faith.
Sure.
and that they continue to be that going forward under Henry and whatever ownership groups follow him.
Right.
I think that's the most important thing to take away.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look back, I think as a Red Sox fan, you can certainly take some pride in the fact that some of the greatest Red Sox players over the last few decades have been people have been men of color.
Yes.
Pedro Martinez, Jim Rice,
David Ortiz.
Right.
Yes.
So certainly the club has come a long way. Obviously, you know, there was the renaming of Yawkey Way that
back to Jersey Street, right?
So that people, you know, were on both sides of that issue. But it was certainly something that at least this ownership group was very aware of and willing to take on.
I mean, it's so many issues of race go back to, are you willing to have the conversation?
Right.
And are you willing to make changes based on the conversation? And I think that this ownership group, you know, whether it's through renaming Yawkey Way or, you know, launching their Take the Lead initiative with the Celtics, the Patriots, and the Bruins to try to eradicate racism in the stands, you know, try to, you know, sort of police the fans and sort of take that out of their athletic venues.
Yep.
I think that's commendable. That started in 2017. And, you know, I think it's just important that, you know, professional sports franchises, the Red Sox and everyone else, continue to be proactive and encouraging on this issue.
Absolutely. Well, with that, we will wrap up the weekly Twin Bills podcast. Let's see, Bill, a week from now, are you on the road? No, they're back, right?
They're back. I will be here.
That's right. They're back because they come back. They come back to face the Yankees. So we will resume then and see where we are.
No question.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Bill.